I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Welcome to Better Than Life, the Red Dwarf podcast, where comedians talk about the greatest sci-fi sitcom of all time. I'm John, and I'm re-watching the show for the first time in decades, along with you, our lovely listener.
And I'm Fergus, and I have not stopped watching it somehow. Today we're discussing Series 3, Episode 4, Body Swap, with Tom Price.
It's a show about a man who's lost 3 million years in space. His company and evolved cat and a hologram he hates. A fuzzy robot and a ship that's gone senile. We love the jokes and sci-fi stuff, that's why it's better than life.
Last week, we looked at Polymorph. Our guest this week is what I call a polytainer. The many forms. The many forms of shape-shifting Welshman Tom Price, I bet you've never been called that before, include international stand-up comedian, actor, with credits including series regular PC Andy in Torchwood, host of podcasts including My Mate Bought a Toaster and One About Golf, and magic radio presenter, whether you choose to interpret that as a reference to his workplace or to his skills. Both are accurate. He's also a voiceover artist, so this episode is going to be extra smooth, like Welsh butter. Tom Price, bore da, a chroeso i'r podlediad.
Thank you.
Wyt ti'n fan mawr o Gorach Coch?
Yeah, I am a very big fan. I'm a very big fan of Red Dwarf. And
lovely.
I'm a very big fan of that intro. That is the most enjoyable intro I've ever had on a podcast.
No one else has had that tone off, John. Tom. Like no one else has. John preserved that particular timbre just for you there.
I feel like John set up the whole podcast just so he could introduce me. I felt like that was the culmination.
I'm just going to sit back and enjoy the smoothness.
Let the bromance just take its natural course. We're recording this late in the evening.
Should we all just get really close to the mic, and that's how we'll do the whole episode.
I think we should.
Are you trying to make this your voiceover show reel? Is this how you're going to get work?
Maybe.
Is that what you're doing?
That's what you should do, John.
Have you listened to anything I've said? Tom, I'm going to take you back to your childhood.
Oh, God.
First exposure to the crew of Red Dwarf. What was that?
I'm actually closing my eyes for this because when you're doing a podcast, I did a podcast the other day about Alo Alo, which I hold in similar comedic esteem, I might add. In the sort of days and weeks leading up to doing the actual podcast, you watch the stuff that you're going to talk about, and then you find yourself thinking about it in the shower and when you're on the radio and you should be talking about Phil Collins and when you're walking the dog. And I've thought a lot about Red Dwarf, and it's occurred to me that it sits across all of my life thus far. And it starts way back when with my brothers. I have two much older brothers, 8 and 10 years older than me. As is often the case, people have got older siblings. That gives them a way into cooler music and cooler TV. So for me, it was a cool thing that my brother watched, and so I tagged along. it was my comedy awakening. You know, a lot of people our age might go with a kind of Blackadder or maybe a Young Ones, and I watched all those things, but Red Dwarf was the thing that I loved the humour of, but loved the show. So I could recognise jokes in Blackadder, but I didn't really love it. I didn't understand it. I was too young. And I'd recognise the humour in the Young Ones, but I didn't love them. But I would watch Red Dwarf, and there was something there that I understood, even at a very young age, because it is so incredibly well written. That was it. So I was in from a very early age, following my brothers into the glory.
Were you getting it all? Or were you sort of laughing a second after them to begin with, just trying to figure out what was so funny?
I mean, no, definitely not getting it all. Probably thinking I was. I loved the cat. I remember very, very clearly the cat on the backwards episode, which is a couple of episodes before Body Swap, which is the one we're talking about today. I think it's episode one or two of that series, three. And the cat weeing backwards at the end of that episode is an iconic moment for me. Like, not only do I think it's hilarious, but understanding the joke, properly understanding it, connecting with it at a very young age. Probably, I mean, this came out when I was 9. So just when you're starting to not just say willies and bums, although technically this is just a willy joke, but it's so sophisticated. It was so clever. They you know, now looking at it with our comedy goggles on, we can go, God, you knew you had this joke. They probably knew they had that waiting for them the whole time. When they first sat down, Rob and Doug, and invented a world where everything's backwards, one of the first thoughts would have been, oh, you imagine if you go to the toilet. Amazing, amazing. Keep that powder dry.
The last moment.
Yeah, they're playing the most important comedy trick you can, which is keep the powder dry. And it picked my brain up and swiveled it around and put it back down again. And that was it. It was a DNA change in me after watching this. The other thing as well that occurs to me is watching how well they do with the restrictions of special effects and budget. You know what I mean? You're watching 5 set piece scenes. That's all you're watching, really. And they managed to, I mean, some of the effects are awful, but who cares? You just don't care.
I thought the little miniature spaceship chase in this episode, Body Swap, was quite dynamic.
Yeah.
It's only 3 shots long, but still, it's cool.
Yeah.
Looks cinematic, even.
Well, mate, yeah. I mean, there's loads of moments where you go, oh, God. Like in, it's the one before when there's the thing sucking stuff out of them when they lose the polymorph, yeah. And the polymorph rears up behind them, and it looks awful. It's rubbish, but I just don't care. So yeah, it was a very early awakening, and I really, really, really got into it, hook, line and sinker. I remember there was a day at school when I was probably about 12, so this is early 90s now. It was some sort of innovations day, and we had to sort of parade inventions we'd like to make. And so I got a toaster and I put it on a table and I hid under the table and I did the toaster thing. Hey there, I'm the toaster. How are you guys? I'm a toaster. What do you make? Toast. I mean, I sat under this table, hidden. I mean, this is probably a bit of a reach, but I was improvising. People were talking to me. They were asking me questions. And I was learning comedy at school. Like, this is a serious deal for me. This is what I ended up doing.
Did the kids at school know what you were doing? Like, did they get, was it referenced?
Yeah.
Or did they just think that you were a kind of avant-garde comedy genius?
Do you know what? My memory is that they did. My memory is that they understood what I was doing. But the reality is probably not, no. But by 12 or 13, I think we were all watching Red Dwarf. I think it... Also, you forget how little choice there was. There was not much else to watch, so...
Yeah.
You know, it sort of sat across so many different things. Like, there was a teacher at school who everyone hated called Smeg. That was his nickname. And I won't name his actual name, but he was a nasty piece of work. And I remember he sat in on a French lesson once. We'd been told to do work and he just had to sit there while we worked. And we hated him and we knew that he didn't know a word of French. So we came up with the reflexive verb maigre and we started declining it.
Oh no.
Je me maigre. Tu te maigre. Il smègre, elle smègre. And we were all just sitting there declining this Red Dwarf French film. I mean, how snotty little private schoolboy is that? But it was absolutely hilarious. I remember finding it so funny.
There's no sweeter or funnier taste than baffling an adult.
Yeah, exactly. Stuff.
Was season 3, was that your first... Sorry, I keep saying season up in Americanized. Was series 3 your first series?
Do you know what? Yes, I think it was, because I don't remember the previous iteration. I don't remember Norman's version of Holly. So, yeah, I remember my brother telling me that used to be a Holly who was a man, who I subsequently gigged with. And that's the thing as well. I mean, as we talk more, we'll get into all that. But, like, I've met them all now. Watching this back and to think that as an adult I've now got to see them all and meet them all is just absolutely so cool. It makes me so happy that I've done that. It does. It makes me feel really smug. And sort
it's awesome. Everyone who's been on who's met them says nothing but nice things.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Oh, no.
I ended up doing the warm-up for the recording of one of the new episodes.
Oh, wow.
And I hope it's not too indiscreet of me to say they don't get on.
Really? Oh. Oh, no.
They're just so different. They're so, so different. But because of the characters they all play, why it's such a great bit of work, because they are four entirely different people. Robert Llewellyn sort of does belong hosting a show about electric cars online, which is now huge. Like, he's had huge success with that. He is a lovely, engaging, he's a really, really lovely man. Danny is just, he's great, he's brilliant, he's fantastic actor. Possibly, I'd say, him or Chris, the best actors in it. But Danny was very much in the zone. And
do you happen to know if it was episode 1 or episode 6? Like, it was the back end of a long record?
Yeah, no, of course. All those caveats need to be sort of injected urgently, because, of course, you don't know how tired they are and what's been going on. Craig Charles was very short with me because I was doing warm-up and he wanted me out on the stage. He didn't know why I was in the dressing room, but I'd literally come in to say hello. Which, you know, it's fine. Maybe that's where he was that day. It was probably in about 2018, I would guess, 2017, okay. Something like that.
It was the Dave era, though, right?
Yeah, the Dave era. It was good. It was a good episode. It's very funny. I don't know. I wondered, is that just their way of working? Maybe that's just the way they go about doing these jobs. And also, when you've done things for that long, you probably do just want to get out there and get it done, and you're probably focusing and concentrating, because it was tight, it was good. Like, to move into more positive territory, they're really good performers, they nailed it. You know, they were precise, it was very detailed, like they knew exactly what they were doing, and I didn't feel like they were going to their audience and going, God, thank you guys, you know. It felt a bit like they were just a bit detached from that, and there's a lesson in that as well. If you do comedy, you know, you've got to learn that it is a job, and you are going to have bad days, and you are going to find yourself, if you're in a successful show, there'll come a time when you've done it for ages and you do have to go through the motions a bit.
It's like a band, isn't it, or something? A lot of great bands are made up of such disparate individuals that get on, but when they're together, they make amazing music. Maybe that's where those guys are.
Yeah, I think so. Honestly, I'm absolutely not going like, oh, they're just not nice people or anything at all, because I've met them all individually. In fact, I did a comedy pilot with Chris Barry and I got to know him really well, and I really like him. The other option as well, and this might be a much more valid point, is that they were nervous. I think they were nervous because it might have been when the big reunion first happened, maybe?
Yeah, if it was series 10, that first day of series.
Maybe they were just bloody nervous.
Let's pick up on the performances then. So Chris, you reckon, is your number one as Rimmer. What is it about Chris's performance as Rimmer that sets him on that pedestal?
He commits. He obeys the number one rule of comedy, which is all you've got to do to be funny is play everything as if it is absolutely real. I believe every single beat of his. Whereas with a lot of the other characters in it, there are moments where I go, if I'm being ultra critical, I might go, Whereas Rimmer, I feel he is so on it and so good. And the fact that he's a hologram and therefore somehow anchored to the spaceship, it feels like it's a world built around him. He feels like number one for me. I don't think everyone feels like that, do they? I think everyone assumes Lister is their number one. It's the story of Lister, right?
It's Lister's story, but I think Rimmer's a common favourite. It's who we laugh at, right? And that's got to be...
Yeah, I see it as Rimmer's story. These people have invaded his spaceship. He's stuck there. I think the tragedy of him being a hologram is brilliant. And that is a big part of Body Swap, of this episode. His attempt to de-hologramize himself. Why not? Let's go with it.
Yeah,
that's it.
It's really tragic. And again, the reason Chris Barry's brilliant is because he plays it so well. And this is the truth in all good science fiction. There is a moment, and it may not last that long, but you really think, how would I be if I lost all physical joy, all physical sensations like eating and sex and all those things and having a hot bath? How would I feel? And that's so good. That's why science fiction is amazing. And then to throw comedy in there as well, like good jokes, good stupid jokes, that is incredibly hard to do, and to do it well with no budget.
Yeah, I guess the thing is with Rimmer, he's the one character, he's not the only one that wants something, but he's the one that, you know, Crichton wants to be able to overcome his programming, but his programming. So at the end of the day, all he needs to do is rewire some circuits and he can not be subservient to everyone and, you know, unable to insult people. Lister... Yeah, he would love Kachansky to be alive, but she's not, and there's nothing.
But apart from that, Lister's having a great time. That's the thing.
He's having fun.
And
he's
so's
just
the
indulging
cat.
In the pleasures of the flesh. The cat is just all pleasures of the flesh. Yeah, Rimmer wants to be something that he can't, and he definitely can't now because he's dead.
Yeah. Rimmer wants to have another go at life, yeah. And he can't. And that is like,
yeah.
You know, Crichton wants to sort of service life around him. Lister just wants to live his life. Cat wants everyone to love his life as much as him. And Rimmer can't do any of those things because his life is gone. Like, it's
yeah.
Just what a trap. I find he's easily the most compelling character, and it's helped by the fact that he's played by the best actor.
The amazing thing is he wanted to have another go constantly when he was alive as well. How many times has he failed the astro engineering exam? Like 13 times he's taken it or something.
Yeah.
He's always wanted to have another go, and it's always someone else's fault when it doesn't work out.
Oh.
And he's now doomed to an eternity of that. But the alternative is being switched off. So he'd rather live in misery than be obliterated.
Yeah. I'll still cling on. How sad is that? I'll still cling on in that. It's that wonderful thing with all good sitcoms, and I always think of Friends for this, where, you know, which one are you, Monica, Joey, Chandler? Red Dwarf has got that in spades. It takes four elements. It almost cauterizes all of us and says you are one of these four people. And actually, we're all a bit of all of them.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I wonder how scientifically those guys sat down and worked that out. You know what I mean? And properly, they've got every single human behavior in those four people, I would say.
I like that as a theory. Did you have a character you identified with most when you were a kid?
The toaster.
And does it change now rewatching the toaster? Just love that toast.
Love that toaster. That's why my podcast is called My Mate Bought a Toaster. Did I have a character I identified most with? Probably Lister.
What was it about Lister? Just that he's the most childlike.
Yeah, he wants to be cool and you know, he always wanted to live for the moment. I don't know. He just had a kind of proper sort of... He's a teenager, isn't he?
Yeah.
Lister is a teenager.
Yeah. Mm.
How many ages of man are there? Is it seven?
Seven, yeah.
You could probably slot each of the four of them into the different ages of man, couldn't you? You've got a teenager, I guess, in Cat, maybe a suave sort of someone in their 20s who just is out there wanting to take his beautifully finished product out to the world. Am I pushing this to destruction, this
No,
analogy?
We love this stuff. It's great. I can't wait to see if it actually works.
Rimmer is surely the middle age, is the patriarch, isn't he?
Mm.
He wants to be the grandee who everyone sits around the fire listening to and pay attention to. And then Crichton is maybe like a sort of, I don't know where this is going. Crichton is like a kind of, I don't know, I need to find an age for Crichton to make this work.
Who's the old one walking with a stick? Holly, probably. Right?
Yeah. Certainly in the first series, when no one was doing it. Hey, I don't know if Crichton's serving people. I don't know. Crichton's a robot, so it's hard to slot in.
It's the duty mode. That's parenting age, isn't it?
Yes. Oh, my God. Yes, thank you. Yes, exactly. He's the parent.
So Rimmer's at the point where the kids have flown the nest. I mean, God, imagine being Rimmer's kids. But, like, he's that older, grown-up, pre-senility.
You'd say that Rimmer and Crichton are mum and dad, right?
Yeah.
And then you've got a teenager in Lister. And the cat is the 20-year-old who hasn't left home yet, but really should crack on now. But all these dynamics are there. Like,
I love it.
There's not many sitcoms where you can really dig in and do that. And it works. And the reason it's pleasing is because it really works. And it informs on stuff. So that what a joy it must be when you've built this world. And I know someone who wrote with Rob Grant. Or maybe it was Doug. Anyway, my friend years ago, Hills, wrote a pilot with one of them. And she said it was incredible because you just did all the work on building the blocks, and then to write the episode took us a day because you've got the work done. You know,
amazing.
You've done all the masking tape, and you've got the curtains away, and you've put you've put the plastic down on the carpet, and you just paint, and every time you can change your color, dun 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 dun. That's why it's so funny. That's why it's so good, because every single half joke you've ever thought of, work. You find a place for it to work.
Yeah,
you find someone who's going to make that funny. So you're just like. To be able to mine your writer, is it going to be easy with this stuff?
That's really interesting as well, knowing you've built the characters well enough that you can distribute delegate jokes amongst them. That's a really interesting way of thinking about it. Earlier on, why was Cat chosen to be the one with the reverse toilet gag in backwards? It's because they knew he could do it best, right? Like that would be the funniest way of doing that particular outcome.
Yes,
and the performer elevates it, because apparently it was Danny's idea to do all the stuff with, you know, with everything being raised, the eyebrows.
Oh, was it?
Apparently a lot of that came from Danny.
Oh,
yeah,
God, it's so lovely.
And that's the other thing. They know that they've got a cast that will add a sprinkle of magic dust on top of whatever they've written.
I can remember, God, this is a memory I'm just getting now. This is so weird talking about this stuff. I can really clearly remember pausing the VHS. I had it on VHS, and I paused it as Cat walks up. And I know this isn't Body Swap. This is a previous episode we're talking about. As he walks up the steps and he's about to get onto the bug, Rimmer starts to corpse.
Oh, definitely.
Or maybe it's Lister.
No, they both do. I had a little question about that. I think they both corpse, but then I got a bit cynical and wondered if it wasn't a bit of deliberate corpsing.
I think Rob and Doug, and certainly Ed Bye, the director, were purists. They wouldn't have allowed that character to be broken.
Fair enough, yes.
And they fade it really quickly. So you can just see it.
There's definite corpsing in that moment.
Definite corpsing.
Being serious.
That's another interesting thing about this. In order for the sci-fi to work, the comedy has to come second to the sci-fi, I think. You have to have a watertight concept that you know is really clear. Clarity. So this is a body swap episode where they have this tech and they can... you have to have that. Why does it work? How does it work? Da-da-da. Okay, fine. Then you can build the stuff around it. You have to
it's
have...
definitely...
Yes, you're right.
The sci-fi scaffolds the jokes.
Yeah.
Certainly
yeah.
This series.
It's perfectly encased comedy, isn't it? You've got the stuff that's growing organically out of the characters, and then you've got the stuff that is dictated, the form, the function of the sci-fi concept of the week that drives the gags in a certain direction. Oh, I love it.
Yeah.
It's really nice. Probably that's why it's so gag-packed. It's quite forward-looking, I think, in terms of the writing.
Mm.
We bring up Futurama quite a lot in relation to, oh, they nicked that from Red Dwarf, maybe.
Oh, yeah.
But actually just that style of writing where it's joke, and they're constantly peppering in jokes that don't really make sense in the world of the show, but they're just brilliant, so they're there.
And you love them. How many writers do you think there were on Futurama compared to this?
Mm. Right, yeah.
I mean, it's unreal what they've managed to do. You know, it's such a tribute to them.
You're going very deep, man. It's really nice. Not everybody has gone this deep. I think it's lovely.
But it's all there. That's the thing. It's all there. Why would you not go this deep? The show is all about the meaning of it. It's all about what the show means.
No matter how brilliant this cast is, I'm now going to ask you the ultimate hell question. If you were recasting Red Dwarf, who would you put in those shoes?
I feel like I should have had more. I should have thought about this one. You did ask me. You sent me an email with this question on. I've not thought about it at all. What I will do then, I will populate it with 4 stand-up comedians, right? Because I believe generally stand-up comedians are the best actors. So I will be casting myself as Crichton.
Yes, why not?
I will be casting Andrew Scott, who's not a comedian, as Rimmer.
Wait, Andrew Scott as in...
The sexy priest.
Sexy priest.
Among many other things, sexy priest.
From Sherlock.
Fleabag.
Is he in Sherlock? Was he in Sherlock?
Yeah,
was that his
he was the baddie.
Yeah, he was in Sherlock. It was Moriarty, yeah.
For Lister, Stephen Graham. It's Lister.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. Yep. Stephen Graham and Andrew Scott going at it. This is going to be murder.
Very dark.
Yeah, it's quite dark, isn't it?
A line of duty on a spaceship.
Oh, you know Jed Mercurio is writing that now.
For the cat, I am going to cast...
John, while he's thinking, did you notice that he said 4 stand-ups, but the only stand-up he's
mentioned
I know,
it's myself.
Is that not weird?
I don't like sharing a green room with other funny people.
Yeah, stand-ups because they're brilliant, they're the best actors. So he's now just going to
so
cast
me.
2 of the best actors probably of their generation, but he will be better than them because he's a stand-up.
I would cast as the cat the comedian Maisie Adam.
Oh, wow.
Nice.
Love Maisie, yeah.
It's not great casting, but she's so funny. A slightly sort of northern laconic cat would be an interesting twist.
I can't let you go without a Holly, but I'll be merciful. You only have to pick 1 Holly. You don't have to do 2.
Do you know what? I'd probably cast Maisie Adam as Holly. That's a much better bit of casting.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd cast Maisie Adam as Holly, and then as the cat, I would cast Joe Lycett.
Mm. Wow. This is a very interesting cast. I like it. Oh, people's answers to this are fascinating. It's great. I'll tell you something else that's great. It's the kind of links I do. The episode Body Swap. Or is it? Let's find out. Fergus, will you remind us what on earth happens?
Thanks, John. A scutter has gone insane and is causing huge amounts of chaos. Evidenced by 2 things. 1, a shot of a scutter doing something with wires, which we're later told is insanity. And 2, Red Dwarf's self-destruct module has gone missing. It turns out the scutter hid the self-destruct in a vending machine, set to go off if anyone orders a milkshake and a crispy bar. Along comes Lister, determined not to touch anything on the ship lest it blow up. And while telling the cat not to touch anything, he casually orders a milkshake and a crispy bar and sets off, inevitably, the ship's self-destruct sequence. Only the voice and brain of a high-ranking officer can shut the self-destruct sequence down, so Lister undergoes an operation, firstly to remove his brain and store it on a drive. I say drive, it's a dictaphone tape, which Cat instantly manages to drop in some tea. And secondly, to have Officer Brown's personality uploaded into his body. Turns out the whole thing was a waste of panic. Holly removed the actual bomb part of the self-destruct ages ago. However, Rimmer is inspired. What if he could have a go on Lister's corporeality? Test drive the curry cart, put his persona into Lister's body. And Lister agrees on the grounds that Rimmer could help him lose a bit of weight. Lister is, after all, and we can all agree on this, disgustingly overweight. Rimmer can do the exercises Lister can't be asked to. In Lister's body, Rimmer gets to feel stuff for a bit, everybody wins. I feel I barely need to go on. It's almost an editing gag, isn't it? Of course, Rimmer as Lister indulges every base whim, eating mountains of mash and smoking stogies, much to Lister as Rimmer's concern. He also carves off Lister's dreads, which is... That's really bad.
That is bad. Aged well.
Turns out Red Dwarf has a very nice spa and jacuzzi, we find out in this episode. Rimmer as Lister holes up in there, still smoking, still indulging, and crucially... not doing any of the things he told Lister he'd do to help with his fitness. In fact, he's put on 2 stone, but has been fooling the others by wearing a girdle. Or hernia prevention belt, as he puts it. Lister as Rimmer forces Rimmer as Lister to promise no more troughing. Rimmer promises, and then immediately breaks that promise, caught having a midnight feast in the bunk below. It's like he wanted to get caught. So it's reasonable that they swap back to their own bodies, which they do. Lister is understandably peeved. Rimmer promised to make him healthier, but actually he's just added moobs and a gut. Lister says, "You are never having my body again." And again, it's like another editing gag. Rimmer enlists a particularly guileless Crichton to swap bodies with Lister again without Lister's consent. Also, and then does a runner with Lister's body. So Lister as Rimmer convinces Cat to pilot the blue midget spaceship they call White Midget to catch Rimmer as Lister. Rimmer sees them chasing him and threatens to kill Lister's body. Is this a bluff? Is Rimmer bluffing? Yeah, obviously. There follows an awesome model shot spaceship chase, which results in Rimmer in Lister's body suffering an almighty crash. We cut to a while later. Lister's back in his body, and everything is fine. Third editing gag. In comes Cat. Rimmer's nicked his body now too. Lovely punchline. End of episode. Yay. Tom, whose body would you swap with if you could?
I would swap my body with my 16-year-old self, and I'd be a lot more careful with my hairline. Is that an option? Or my dog, maybe? If I could swap for a day, I'd like to be in my dog's body just for a day.
The next episode is called Time Slide, so you can slide around in time and bodies if you fancy. You can go back to your old... In fact, I was going to mention that the 3 titles here, Polymorph, Body Swap and Time Slides, we're hard sci-fi now, aren't we? We're making up words.
Is this where they're really getting into their stride now in terms of the sci-fi stuff? Is this where they really start the bigger ideas come through, or is it much of a muchness and they've all, up to this point, all the episodes have had this sort of, these concepts all the time?
First 2 series pretty much exclusively happened on Red Dwarf. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, that's probably a budget thing.
And I think a conscious decision by Grant and Naylor to keep it as a wee clo, Hell Is Other People, little sitcom. Yeah. But yeah, I think they got a lot more money this series, certainly.
Yeah, but that can ruin series. Sometimes that can ruin things because what we love about it is the trap.
Yeah. Agreed.
They definitely feel unleashed in this season. Right? The whole backwards episode, there's the great big alien and everyone's playing different versions of themselves. And you've got this with all the voice swapping. They're experimenting in a way that they didn't in the first couple of series.
Time travel, multiverses.
They're also, if you look at the thing that is in common with all those plots, every single one of them is that we now know them well enough to mess around with.
Yes.
Grant and Naylor really know how to get the characters out through the stories.
Yeah.
It's quite a weird episode, this. I'm not sure it's great. I like it, because like we talked earlier on, I just love all of it, really.
It was preceded by Backwards, yeah. Marooned, which is just Lister and Rimmer trapped on a crashed spaceship together for like most of the episode, episode.
The guitar.
And Polymorph, right? That is a tough act to follow. That's a good first half of a series.
And you know what happens, don't you, as one? You can see it in this thing, that all the episodes can go in any order. So they make them and then they can shift them around. So this is burying a bad track.
They stacked.
They're burying a bad track at the end of the album. I'm not saying that, but I that's probably got some legs.
I think it might boil down to an aesthetic thing. The idea is sound, right? What if Lister and Rimmer swap bodies? Brilliant. Mm. Why would they do that? Because of Rimmer's delusion, as per. But I think the aesthetic of it, the fact, the overdubbing, recording the voices at a later date in a studio with a different, closeness of microphone and a different... There's something removed about the performances of Rimmer and Lister in this.
Definitely.
When they're swapped voices. Yeah. And that does detract from the immediacy that they can't play out in this. They can't do the little vocal throws.
Yeah, because it's the first time it's a studio, a non-live audience sitcom. Mm. So, there's definitely something in that. Yeah, and as soon as the body swap happens as well, I remember that moment. I love the joke when cat drops the personality in a cup of tea. And I think, you know, all good sitcoms are pulling at tiny threads, right, all the time. And I was like, oh, do they pull at the thread of the tea? Is that what happens? And then when he comes back, you know what I mean? I forgot how this episode unfolds. And I thought that's going to be the tiny thread that gets pulled out.
Oh, almost like an anti-Flowers for Algernon thing where he comes back a bit.
Exactly. Yeah, messed up by right. Theanine or whatever drugs are in tea. and I thought that'd be amazing, right? And then the body swap happens and the person appears and you hear her voice. Leah Williams, by the way. And yeah, that's right. I've got Wikipedia in front of me. And I'm a bit disappointed when I hear her voice. I go, oh, okay. But she then tries to stop the alarm, fails. You've got the great joke of the alarm being wrong.
Yeah.
Really funny joke. Yeah. And that they spent a lot of time setting that up. What you should have at that point is, oh, the alarm is fine, but we've got a problem. Now we're stuck. But they don't, because his personality gets put back in. And then, oh, there's this idea of actually you can do swaps. So let's do a why don't you and me swap? That is the set piece moment, which should be the problem locked in for the rest of the episode for them to solve. And it's not. They spend half an episode or however long it is setting up that thing. And then they go, but it's fine because now we swap back. And then they have the fun in the second bit. So it's
a weird structure.
It's a weird structure.
Mm. It is quite anomalous, this episode, because usually they do that thing the Simpsons did a lot in the first 15 series where they'll spend a good 40 to 50% of the episode just doing fun random gags and then the story kicks off. Whereas in this one, it does feel like the story is important. The first few scenes do play into what happens, but it's
very odd start.
It's linear and three acts instead of two, and it's you're right, it's a split structure and it does feel odd.
It does feel odd and it's not, again, it's not pulling, it's setting something up and going, right, now you understand this new thing about our world, now let's have fun with it. Whereas what normally happens is they go, here's a thing about our world, and as you're learning about the thing about our world, it's also falling apart. That's joyful, because they're going, it's the clown thing, isn't it? It's your basic clown of walking out and going, look at what I've made, and as they hold it, it's collapsing right in front of you. That's funny, right? Because you've got pride and it's falling apart, and that's clowning, that's comedy. And what they're doing is going, look at what we've made, it's fine, it works. Okay, now we'll carry on. And that's a disconnect.
I thought it was really interesting, Tom, that you just identified two alternative ways that the plot could have gone. And I was thinking about them as you were talking. I was listening as well to what you were saying. But there's a This Is Your Brain on Tea episode where Lister just goes weird because his mind's been dropped in a cup of tea.
Yeah.
What does that do? And then there's Officer Brown or whatever her name is. You know, she's stuck in Lister and where's Lister and we can't get her out. And it occurred to me that both of those, right, they'd be very different episodes, obviously, but the thing about both of those is there's a kind of level of jeopardy where you'd be going, like, on one level you'd know, obviously, Lister will come back at the end of the episode, of course he will, but you wouldn't know how it was going to happen. There is something, and this has only occurred to me because you've identified those other ways the plot could have gone, there's something about it being, oh, Rimmer's swapped, and you know that Rimmer is going to lose.
Yeah.
So it sort of makes it a bit less interesting, I think, perhaps.
Yeah, it's definitely less interesting. I didn't... Yeah, exactly that.
It's one of the first episodes that does kick off a theme, which is that there's some really good sci-fi, there's some really good tech, but because it's Lister and Rimmer and Crichton and Kat using it, it messes up.
Yeah.
That happens a lot in Red Dwarf, and I think this is the first... Well, maybe Better Than Life, but this is definitely one of those where you go, God damn, if Rimmer was just a normal person... Mm. This could actually have worked out okay.
So
actually it is sci-fi, but is the confluence of the sci-fi idea and a very specific characteristic in Rimmer that makes all the gags work. Yeah. And that is a lot to swallow.
Also, the opening is so high stakes. The whole ship's going to blow up. And the time keeps getting shorter every time Lister presses anything.
To be fair, they did that two episodes earlier in Marooned with five black holes.
Oh, they did. Yeah, that's true.
Oh, no, sorry. Good point. Just specks of dust.
It's grit.
So good. So good.
Yeah, that's it.
What I would have done is set up the ship's going to blow up. And that sits across the whole episode. And then you have at the end, the joke would have been so much more satisfying if the milkshake had come out at the end of the episode.
Right,
that would be
end.
So much funnier if they go through absolute hell to try and solve it. So you give them more time to do that. And then the problem would then be they realize they have to do the swap, but Rimmer gets in the way because he's desperate to get a body again. So then that happens with the jeopardy of the ship going to blow up sitting across it. Like it's a simple solution. But as we've said, what happens is they go, oh, that's all sorted. And now here's a weird thing where, and also like Crichton helping him is just doesn't work for me.
They lampshade it. They have to. Yeah. They have to have Crichton saying, I don't feel good about this. But that kind of does draw attention to the
program to obey no matter how insane as well. Like they even have to add in no matter how insane.
It's a nicely delivered line.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
I do enjoy seeing how evil Rimmer can be. I think that's quite a nice, like how how absolutely horribly selfish he is.
Well, here's the thing, why it might feel a little segmented. Had they given Chris Barry the opportunity for Rimmer to play, I'm having an idea right now. The two parts of the story don't overlap.
That's right.
But a question is, like, when does Rimmer actually have the idea? If they just had a shot of him going, then those two bits might have
come. But also, or Rimmer would have fallen in love with that Officer Brown.
Ah, brilliant.
Like all good sitcoms, what's the solution? And all good fiction as well. You love it when someone sets up a problem and you go, I don't know how they're going to solve this, but it's not my problem, it's theirs. And you watch someone solve it in an ingenious, imaginative way, which is at once surprising and amusing and a leap, but also totally feasible. It's got to be feasible. The problem here isn't really ever sort of solved. You know, if they're stranded on the ship, it gets solved. Someone will come and rescue them, or they find a thing. Hang on one second. If we just put this MacGuffin in here and twist it that way, oh my God, you've done it. There isn't that in this. There isn't that. Take the MacGuffin, take it outside and it's frozen, then it's going to work. You don't get that. And that's all so satisfying. I always enjoy that moment in any good plot when they go, here you go. This is the key to unlock it all.
It's a person. They try to do it with a person, and then the MacGuffin is almost the bluff of him destroying Lister's body.
But that's an on-the-wayer. That would be funnier if Lister's body was being destroyed to serve them rescuing the ship. If Rimmer said, look, the only way we're going to rescue the ship is by me being in your body and doing these things. Okay, fine. Oh, by the way, while I'm in your body, I'm going to make you fat. That is funny, because Lister is having to let it happen. Do you know what I mean? As opposed to he just sort of lets it happen and has to sit there going, oh, can you not do that? But, you know, it's all good.
I think thematically there's interesting things. Let's go full English degree while we're here, right? So body over soul is an obvious theme, but I think actually it's more of a comment on our casual reliance and on tech. I don't find the moment when Lister orders a milkshake and a crispy bar to be about stupidity or fecklessness. That's just, he doesn't even consider that to be touching anything.
Yes.
And later on, the casualness with which Rimmer treats this newfound, to them at least, tech that allows him to take over other people's bodies.
Selfish greed. I want my food. Greed. I want my body back. Greed. You know, it's a dim view, because we're an awful species.
And again, not aided by the aesthetic of those post-ADR, like those voices, making everything sound more sullen than it actually would be were they live.
You haven't got the live, the electricity of it and the excitement of it.
Also, not to lay into the show too much, but could they not have got a second take of the bit where Crichton pulls the syringe out of Lister's head?
Just
one little, like, you can see Bobby Lee goes, oh, it's slipping, and puts fingers on it.
Yeah.
Get a second take.
To go again.
Robert, that was great, but do that thing with the fingers at the start, that way it won't slip.
Yeah.
Cheers, love.
Once more, thank you so much, for God's sake.
Hattie Heyridge doesn't play it as such, but Holly, especially in the first two series, Norman Lovett's Holly, does have a habit of playing pranks on the characters. He can cite it as deliberately torturing Lister, in fact, to keep him sane, like bringing Rimmer back. Hattie Heyridge does not play it like Holly's done a deliberate gag here.
No.
But it could have been, right? She could have easily asked for a kind of, there could have been a line tweak where it's like, oh yeah, did you not, I didn't think that was worth.
Hang
she
on,
does which, say you never asked.
Which bit,
that
which
feels
bit
like she was
about?
Agentic. The self-destruct thing. Holly knew all along that there was no bomb. There was just the countdown. She didn't tell anyone.
She didn't tell anyone. Of course, you never asked. Yes. Dun, 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 dun. those for me way more effective than doof 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 doof.
Oh yeah, they do good punchlines, I think, on this show. Backwards, the last line is that don't ask.
Don't ask.
Beautiful.
Somebody needs to do a YouTube where they just take loads of endings of EastEnders and put the beginning of sitcom theme tunes from the 80s over it.
It's they've done it with Curb. There's a lot of memes.
Oh, of course they have. Bum, that's bum, perfect. Bum.
But I think putting Red Dwarf over things is actually a very okay, thanks guys. Cheers.
That's a really good idea.
Get my iMovie up and running.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
L- look, to grab a random thing. And also, here's another thing as well, and this is sort of away from the episode, but Red Dwarf has a biography of the life of Tom Price. My wife loved it as a kid, and it was something we really bonded over very early on. And I knew she was a keeper when she said she was obsessed with Red Dwarf as a kid. She always talks about the definitive Red Dwarf moment is when they realize they can go back in time. They spend all that time getting ready to go back in time. They get into costumes for 1632, whatever year it is. And then it happens, and they realize they're still miles out in space. But it's just like, it is the last vestiges of a deeply flawed and selfish and greedy and pretty horrible race floating into the sun, you know, or just floating off into, and it comes back to that every single time. So when they are all being stupid, they're just on a sort of box flying out into the ether. It's brilliant.
That's true, but that makes it both wholly unimportant what they do with themselves and also extremely important, doesn't it? They are the last of humanity.
Yeah, burning Shakespeare books or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. Let's talk about bodies a little bit, okay? Because there's two things that need discussion, I think, about this episode. Lister isn't fat.
He's really
That's ridiculous. That's by any metric. He's who the hell is going to look at him and go, whoa.
He pushes his tummy out and I was like,
you're pushing your tummy out.
It's fine. You're just pushing your tummy out. It's fine. They should have. Yeah, but again, budget-wise, these days they'd have done a really good job, wouldn't they? They'd have given him the full moniker.
Yeah, the full whale. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, didn't Neil Morrissey have he did the same thing in Men Behaving Badly, but he kept it up for a whole episode and really hurt himself, apparently.
Did he?
Yeah, that rings a bell, yeah.
Yeah, no, he's not fat. Yeah, he's not fat.
But also, Rimmer gives the speech about, it's the age when everything slows down. And cites that age as 24, 25.
Come on. On all the levels, come on.
How old were they when they were filming this? Were they all in their 20s?
Craig Charles would have been... No, the Grant and Naylor were in their 30s, at least mid-30s.
God. Do you know what? They might all have been... Okay, they look older than 20s, don't they? But they might all have been in their 20s, actually.
They probably were.
It's the 80s. Everyone looked older in the 80s.
Yeah. No one drunk enough water.
24, 25 is the age where everything slows down.
Yeah, no, it's
for Grant and Naylor. Come on, but... Maybe in the 80s.
Oh, God. Come on. I don't like to think about that. That's just terrifying. I remember being on campus at uni and there was a mature student who lived with us. He was 22. And as far as I was concerned, he was all but dead.
Everyone talks about Chris Barry being a very good mimic. I like Craig Charles's performance as Rimmer's physicality.
He has a lot of fun with it, doesn't he?
Well, is this the only look to camera we get in Red Dwarf? When he sees Lister's privates? I mean, that's straight down the barrel.
I think it might be, actually.
Maybe. Yeah. Getting the tongs out was very funny.
yeah, that's a good one.
I always think this in any body swap sort of setup or film or whatever. Does the other actor say, well, look, I'll do it. Here's what I'll do if I'm playing this moment. And I'd stand like this. Because they stand differently. They really do mimic very well physically. Obviously, the audio is a bit of a cheat, which I thought was a shame.
Yes,
if I was doing that now, I wouldn't bother with it. You don't need the sound, just act it. Yeah, it's fine. Yeah, we'll get it because the words are there.
Maybe they would have thought it was unfair because Chris Barry could have done, will have done his impeccable Scouse Lister impression.
And maybe Craig Charles
couldn't have maintained that the Rimmer voice very well to the same degree.
I was watching it and going, God, why is the... Yes, it's jarring, but it's more jarring coming from one than the other. And at first I thought, oh, it's because Craig's really good at ADR. And then I realised, no, it would be because Chris was doing the cadence and everything.
Yeah.
And therefore it was easier for Craig to match it because he wouldn't have been doing such a good Chris Barry as Rimmer impersonation for Chris Barry to then sync up to. Yeah. Also, there's something about the timbre, I reckon, of, you know, Craig's got a more manly voice, which sounds less weird coming out of someone who looks like Chris than the other way around. Yeah,
right. The north and south of Britain divide in Rimmer and Lister becomes a problem in this moment because there's a moment where you see Lister mouth the word much, you know, with a northern accent, is more of a pursed lip.
Kissy.
Much.
Kissy face, yeah.
But you hear Chris Barry's voice saying much.
Doesn't work, yeah.
Yeah.
But then you'd have to be looking pretty closely to notice that kind of
thing. You'd have to be on a fifth watch to really get that stuff. I think the mimicry is done pretty well. It's easy for me to say.
Yeah.
It's still great.
Craig as sort of unhinged Rimmer towards the end, I think, is really, really great. I love the kind of the glint of madness in his eye.
Yeah.
With the gun to the head and all of that stuff.
Craig Charles is employing some really cool acting techniques, a bit of Simon Peggy this series. Like his fearless character in Polymorph. Yeah, he gets to do faces and pull directly from action movies, basically.
That's a really good shout on the Simon Pegg.
Yeah, he's having some fun. He's being encouraged. Yeah, he's being pushed. He's pushing himself. The script is pushing him, and the stories are pushing him. But it's nice that Rimmer is a nutter. I love that in this, that Rimmer has a glint of madness in his eye, because you look forward to him being back in his hologram box.
Yeah.
You look forward to the safety of him being no longer a danger. Do you know what I mean? It gives
it's
just
interesting
an
to make him dangerous, though, isn't it? That is kind of weird for a sitcom character to be dangerous, like dangerously unhinged, and that prideful, and that mendacious as well.
He's horrible.
Yeah, it is horrible, but there's some really good writing in it. His coercion is a horrible thing to be coercive, but Rimmer's coercion is well done. When he says, never mind, you'd never agree to it. Ah, nice bit of, like, of course that's going to work on Lister. Of course a little bit of reverse psychology is going to needle him.
It's all still
really elegantly done.
When he comes out with his arm, inverted commas, missing, for a second you can almost by that it's happened.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was going to,
Rewatching it for this, I was like, I'm sure this is a joke, but it can't be, because he's just been in a crash. So does he just get it kind of reformed by a med machine?
Yeah, exactly.
Have you guys ever had duck's feet in abalone sauce?
Oh, God, no, nor do I want to.
Not for days.
To be honest. No. It's not quite as appetizing as the fried egg chili chutney sandwich.
No, things that were luxury foods. And interesting, the stuff they order in Better Than Life as well, like luxury foods are nowhere near as appetizing as the supposedly dreadful Lister eats. Duck's feet in abalone sauce.
Is that an actual thing, or is that not
Listener,
just a joke?
Email us. Tell us if you've had that and what it's like. I can't imagine it's nice. Isn't abalone a type of sea slug?
Yes, it is, I think, yeah. Oh, yeah, you get abalone inlays on guitars.
Oh, this is really
fretboards.
That's made out of sea slug.
Abalone, yeah. I don't know if it's real abalone or if it's just like some sort of synthetic that looks like abalone and is therefore known as, in the same way that a tortoiseshell pickguard is not actually tortoiseshell.
Oh, no. Oh, maybe back in the day they were, though, right?
Good news for tortoises.
Actually, do you know what? You talked earlier on about quotes, things that just are in your
Because
head.
I've got so many.
I think we get one in this episode. I think we have an iconic one in this episode. Lister and Cat playing Scrabble, and Cat teaching Lister the word for when you get your sexual organs trapped in something. That feels like a classic sitcom
line. That's good.
It's brilliantly set up, isn't it? I love the pacing of that whole bit. You like, as soon as you've gotten to the punchline of it, you go, God, that was, I did not see it coming.
But
it was perfectly laid out.
Oh, I can't remember any of the quotes. That's so annoying. There are so many in those three or four episodes I've watched preparing for this where I went, oh my God, I used to say that all the time. And now, of course, I can't remember
anything. Yeah.
I think I do actually have a genuine one that's just kind of worked into, maybe not the exact words, but certainly the intonation. When Crichton says, but why did he struggle so? It's beautiful. It's a beautifully written line.
It's nice to have, though, isn't it? My wife and her family all love Father Ted, and they quote Father Ted endlessly. And I've always liked it. I'm not a huge fan. But Red Dwarf was my thing. And I always thought, I don't have something I quote. And then I watched this and thought, I did. I've just forgotten it all. I did. It was Red Dwarf.
Yeah.
But it's every single episode we've watched, I've gone, that's me. It's me. It's so weird. I know you don't want to dig too hard on the nostalgia value of this, but again, it comes back to the meaning thing. It's a version of you shouting back at yourself. I'm not going to put a number on it, but probably 20 years plus. It's a version of you shouting back going, hi, this was you.
Yes.
This was a part of your daily life. And that's lovely.
Do you remember when you were happy?
Yeah.
I really like, you've lost my arm, I've lost your watch too.
Yeah. Nice gag.
But a line that I've written down, I say written, I typed it. When did I last write? Probably when I last watched this episode of Red Dwarf, probably. It was the last time I used a pen. It really struck me what a great use. And I think there's a few great uses of Smeg in this episode, actually. But this is a bit of an all-time.
Oh, there's the smegging, smeggy, the way, smeggy, smeg, smeg, smeg. Yeah.
Oh, Smeg, what the smegging, smegsy, smegging, dunny, smegging killed me. And it's just perfect. It's such a great bit of faux swearing.
But what is it with... I remember watching Battlestar Galactica, the remake, and I was struck by how they invent...
Frack, isn't it?
They invented a swear word, frack. And I remember thinking, it's like Red Dwarf with smeg.
Yeah. I think it's great. I love frack as well. That moment where I think Hilo says, you sick frack. Me and my friend looked at each other and went, yeah, now they're using it correctly. Like they know its power now.
There it is.
You mentioned the rock themes earlier on. This is the first episode, again, where you get a bit of rock time-passing music between scenes.
Yeah.
It feels very inured, very, very much part of the show. But this is the first time it happens.
But does this happen after they've solved the problem and before they go to Act 2?
No, I think it happens near the start. But also, I think there's just a kind of passage of time interstitial model shot. Yeah. But instead of having the usual bam, ba ba da, ba ba da, they have like this just kind of rockin' blues riff. Like Howard Goodall's band was just jamming and they just went, oh, I'll use that.
They'd watched too many episodes of Seinfeld. Bow, 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 and they were
there's,
just trying
there's
to
some heavy bass in it, sure.
Yeah,
it slaps every now and again.
That dates it the most.
Yeah, yeah. I don't like that. I don't approve.
Oh, really?
I like the
bar. You're purist.
Bah, bah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because big. You have to keep coming back to the truth. It's a space opera. It's a space opera that's sung by a shanty band. That's what this is.
I think that's the end of the podcast, isn't it? On that summation, that's pretty genius. Hey, do you have a favourite moment, favourite line, favourite bit?
From this episode?
Or idea from this episode specifically, yeah. It may not be your favourite ep, but do you have a favourite moment?
It may not be my favourite ep, but watching it again was great. My favourite moment is, we've talked about it already, my favourite moment was the tape falling in the cup of tea.
Yeah.
Because it's everything. They're all together as a team. It's tense.
It's the highest stakes moment.
It's a high stakes moment. I noticed the tea and thought, that's going to... It's just, and then going Danny John Jules' timing. Oh, it's just, he could have done it a second earlier or a second later and it would have been 20% as funny. The timing was perfect. It still makes me laugh when I think about it now because it's basic slapstick. There's a really big sci-fi moment happening. Everyone is on brand. Everyone's doing their character at that moment perfectly.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Well, excellent choice. On that note, Tom, thank you so much for being a guest on us on our podcast. You're a legend.
Absolutely loved this.
Where, if people want to kind of find you and call you out online for not enjoying this episode as much as you should have, how can they
all
find
the terrible,
you?
Terrible things that you said.
I know. It's that you're right. Come and harass me on Instagram if you like at the price Tom. And if you have any time left in your ears, then listen to My Mate Bought a Toaster, which is my Amazon purchase history podcast, which you will love. So
yeah, it's excellent.
Have a listen to that.
Tom Price, what a great guest.
What a great guest. Why are you're still doing that voice? Oh, John. It's nice, but then it edges across the nice line into creepsy. Or there'll certainly be listeners out there, hopefully.
Some of them absolutely love it.
Not as much as they love Tom Price as our guest, though. What a chat.
What a chap.
It was a brief tour around the episode. He wasn't as enamoured with that episode as other guests have been with our other episodes.
It's true.
It's a great episode. It is still iconic. It has so many memorable moments and so many, like, it almost works like a Chris Morris thing where it's somehow funnier when you're thinking about the episode as a whole.
Yeah.
After having watched it than when you're actually watching it.
Yeah. The dubbing, it's weird because I don't remember having any problem with it when I was watching it as a kid, but now it takes me out of it, sadly. It's unfortunate. It's got a lot going for it, this episode. It's a bit too ambitious for what they were able to pull off with the technology that they had at the time, I guess.
There's enough story in there for a film, definitely.
Oh, yeah.
Or a 3-episode arc.
Yeah, it's brilliant. It's brilliant in so many ways. And it's I don't know, it's nice to have, this is like the grit in the oyster of the podcast, isn't it? To have one where somebody didn't love the episode. It makes a refreshing change.
Do you know what? You're right. But also, it's not even grit if you're into oysters. It's just a slightly less delicious oyster.
Yes, indeed. It's got loads of good stuff. I love the beginning. I know we've talked about the beginning a bit with Tom, but I think I really like particularly how super serious Chris Barry is being as Rimmer in the beginning. Like, he is seemingly, I know he's not fixing the problem, but it's a massive, complex, wicked problem. There's a mathematician somewhere screaming at me for misusing that term, I suspect. But he appears competent. He appears like someone with grip, like someone who is genuinely trying to solve a life or death conundrum in that moment.
He's saying turn like it's enhance in a cop show. Yeah, he's doing well with that. And he does bizarrely seem to understand the inner circuitry of the spaceship.
Yes, although he understands it in the same way that he understands his astrophysics exam. He might just be seconds away from just planting a big sweaty palm on the screen and just blinking rapidly before saluting and falling over. You don't know.
That's true. I guess all he's doing is processing information. It seems like Crichton's doing whatever the agentic part of that project is.
Yes, you do get the sense that Crichton's doing the actual legwork and thinking, and Rimmer is basically, he stops at the surface level of appearing like a senior man in command.
Well, we know he's a very coercive character in this episode. He's coerced us into believing that he's competent.
Yes, yeah. and he's grooming Crichton to do his bidding.
Yes, you see, Rimmer is evil, yeah, as Tom said, but is it right from the start? Getting Crichton on side. It's not a funny scene. There's nothing funny about him saying turn and the kind of the 3D bit of stuff on the screen, and that's all serious.
Yeah.
Even the shot of the scutter holding some wires, which is...
It's the first thing that you see. It's really, really, like, bizarre. It takes a minute to get your head around what you're actually looking at, yeah. The tension established by playing it really straight at the beginning, then it's a nice release when Lissler initiates the auto-destruct sequence. It's like it's a really big laugh then at that point.
Oh, yeah.
Because it is, you know, it's the classic, this is the one thing we did not want to happen kind of moment, and that's always funny.
But not necessarily played for the maximum amount of laughs in that moment, because it is casually done. He does, he orders the food, turns away and carries on talking. There's no, like, double take moment. There's no moment where Lister gets to realise that he's messed up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Before he's told.
And the number of times he presses it, sending the countdown down by a minute before he finally stops pressing it as well.
That's great.
He's really, really incompetent, actually, in the beginning of this episode. Said Lister.
And he's just bashing it. He bashes it enough times so it goes from 15 to 8 minutes or whatever. Yeah. Like, that's a brilliant gag. And you kind of expect it to carry on, but what would have happened genuinely if he'd just ended up at 2 minutes left? Which is probably what the character would have done if he's that Homer Simpson stupid.
Yeah.
To just keep bashing the thing that says, every time you bash me, it's getting worse for you.
Yeah.
But maybe this is the time when I bash you, it'll get better.
They'd have had to go to Blue Alert at that point.
Which was recently, as of recording, revealed as Doug Naylor's favourite line.
And Rob's as well. They both independently said that. Yeah, that was great.
Yeah,
somebody shared that on the Facebook page. It's BTL Pod.
Nice. Yeah, that's really cool, isn't it? That's John Robertson, as he said, the first joke he told that ever landed.
Yeah, yeah. Stopped him getting beaten up by a school bully. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's Grant and Naylor's favourite thing, what they've ever written for Red Dwarf.
Yeah.
It's amazing they can pinpoint it as well. I guess it is just such a good gag and such... It's half sci-fi, half comedy, yeah. I guess. Or rather, it really does do the thing they originally wanted to do, which is undermine the idea of sci-fi. They undermine the pomp of space operas by making it about something really menial.
What I'm fascinated by is one of them wrote that punchline. They kind of both simultaneously... It's highly unlikely they both simultaneously came in going, oh, I've got this great gag about a Blue Alert and a light bulb. Like, so one of them has written that line. What I would love to know is one of them being super generous... Or have they both forgotten and they both think that they came up with it? I don't know.
Probably Naylor.
Why do you say probably Naylor, Alex?
I think we're saying he might be more of a gag writer, right, or at least by the way the series have developed after Rob Grant left. And it is just a gag throwaway line.
Emailing your theories, listener.
Maybe they both chose it because it is one of the few, that they genuinely somehow co-wrote, that are two different ideas that coalesced into an idea. Or we know that they kind of they chuck lines around, right?
Yeah, they workshopped it.
One of them had the idea, right, let's go to Blue Alert, and then one of them just randomly says, oh, are you sure that doesn't mean changing the bulb? But they would have taken the rest of the week off, right?
I wouldn't have even finished the script. Yeah, I'm just going to say, we've peaked. Enough.
It's never going to get better than this.
But it does.
What did we miss out from this episode? There's a couple of little bits of triv that we should talk about. I mentioned White Midget in my Precy. Some people who've only seen the remaster will be confused by that mention.
Oh, do they change it for the remaster? They correct it?
Yeah, they overdubbed it. They redubbed it, with Blue Midget. Because it is very clearly a blue spaceship.
What was it? Was that just a misreading of the line? Or was it like a misprint in the script? Did it actually say white?
Just unintentionally written in by the writers.
So they'd established it was Blue Midget, but they just kind of accidentally wrote White Midget.
It's so easy to do. You can imagine more from a props master going, I've got to make a lot of stuff happen this episode, like a spaceship chase on a planet. As opposed to through space. That's quite hard to do. They made it look really dynamic.
They really do. There's just something about physical, even though they're like, you know, relatively cheap 80s BBC bulbous spaceships, they just look really cool because they're actually there.
It is really well done, though. I don't know quite how they got the... Blue Midget and Starbug are clearly on wires, but it's really well done. You can't see the wires at all. Peter Ragg was the guy that did the... He was effects supervisor. He'd worked on Thunderbirds previously.
Oh, he had form.
Exactly. In spaceships and chasing.
Yeah, the rocks breaking off the mountain range look really good, actually.
That'll be why they used it twice, yes.
Right, yeah.
It does look good.
Yeah, it made me think of... we were talking with Paul Foxcroft, weren't we, about you were saying about liquids with models.
Big bits to make it look and, big, and slow motion to make it look big as well,
Yeah, but they've nailed it with rocks, clearly. Mm. Well, while we're talking about minor details, here's one that you haven't seen because it didn't make it in, because it was very problematic to film. So this was actually the first they shot out of sequence, as they often did. This was Robert Llewellyn's first episode as Crichton. Quite a hard one to come in on, actually, with no studio audience, now I think about it. But his first scene that he shot, apparently, was there was a bit in the jacuzzi with Rimmer as Lister. We're supposed to see Crichton in that scene, and he's, of course he has, he's got a finger that emits flame, and he uses that to light Rimmer slash Lister's cigar. But unfortunately, it was so incredibly hot on the set of the sauna that he was dying under the rubber makeup, as you can imagine, and he got a mild electric shock from the fire effect. So that was that. Rather than put Robert Llewellyn in danger, they decided maybe we could just live without that gag.
You can see the health and safety chats around that, around the design of that effect.
Yeah.
It's like, well, as long as it doesn't get wet, it's fine. And it's not going to get wet because he's in a, you know, we're in studio. No, he's going to make it wet himself by basting in rubber.
Yes, he is nothing but moisture at that point. He must have been wondering what the hell he got himself in for.
Your first day, you get electrocuted because of the costume you're going to be wearing for the rest of your character. I wonder how optimistic you'll be about this gig. You're already the second act of the play. Like, is it just going to be this one episode again? But am I not going to be on the show because I'm dead?
That would be problematic.
Only in the 80s, not these days. I just CGI you back in. You're fine.
Yeah, deep fake Crichton coming to a hellscape near you soon.
I think we've solved how they're going to do Red Dwarf Titan.
Oh, just, yeah. Just
use a bit of AI deep fakery to de-age them, see what they're like as flipping 15-year-olds.
It would be quite weird because I'm not quite sure physically they could pull off the physicality of their 20s, no matter how convincing the faces are.
Have you seen Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny?
I watched it just the other day, actually.
The young faces.
I enjoyed it way more than I expected to. I've actually had a lot of fun with it. But yeah, it's the voice and the physicality.
Mm. Yeah.
If you, you know, if you want to ruin it for yourself, it's all there for the taking, isn't it?
Yeah.
As I feel like maybe we have kind of comprehensively ruined this episode for ourselves, but there's lots of great stuff in it. We just chose not to focus on those bits.
It's still a favourite. I am intrigued to know. Tell us why you love this episode. But next week, it's just going to get better and better. We're talking time slides.
Yes, we are. We are talking time slides with a man who has thought an awful lot about Red Dwarf. You are going to love hearing from the one and only Duran Jono Johnson.
Yeah, you will. See you there.
It's better than life.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.